Well, welcome once again to another Center for Politics event, and a very special one at that. On behalf of the University of Virginia and the Center for Politics, I'm pleased to welcome Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer to Mr. Jefferson's University and his beautiful dome room. And let's also welcome Montana's lovely First Lady, Nancy Schweitzer. Thank you for joining us, Nancy. I can guarantee you, having just listened to Governor Schweitzer in an hour and a half long edition of American Politics 101, they won't even stay for me for 50 minutes. But they stayed an hour and a half. We had to pull the governor out of the classroom to get him here. He is fun. He is blunt. He is Montana. And he's going to get up and tell you this is BS, and that's the word he used. But it's absolutely true. He's generating a lot of national attention, not just for his political agenda, but for his Western swagger and tell-it-like-it-is approach. The praise for Governor Schweitzer's blunt personality and strong populist convictions come from all sorts of sources. The Wall Street Journal describes him as having a well-spoken, gun-owning, dog-loving, native ritual-doing, shot-of-whiskey-drinking, True West style. Now, it's hard to... John Wayne reincarnated. Really, that's what it sounds like to me. CBS's 60 Minutes, I hope all of you saw that on Sunday. Leslie Stahl was nice enough to schedule that right prior to his visit here to Charlottesville. Just kidding. But we appreciate the fact that they did it on Sunday. Called Governor Schweitzer part Renaissance man and part rodeo cowboy. I'm not sure what that means, but you'll see. Governor Schweitzer put himself through college by mopping floors at sororities. Just the floors? At the sororities? That's very suspicious, Governor.
I guess I'm a Democrat.
Oh, there you go. You see what I mean?
We do have weaknesses.
You see what I mean? Okay. He got a master's degree from Montana State in soil sciences, and then worked 8 years on irrigation projects in the Sahara Desert and in Saudi Arabia. He returned to Montana in the late 1980s and built a farming and ranching business from scratch. He ran a very colorful campaign for U.S. Senate in 2000 and snuck right up on Senator Conrad Burns, who thought he'd be reelected easily, as he always has been. He lost by a smidgen. And he wounded Burns so badly that Burns is in deep trouble and may well lose his reelection bid this year. You may remember that Governor Schweitzer was the first political figure to organize bus trips to Canada to help seniors purchase low-priced prescription drugs. His strong showing in that 2000 Senate race led to the Democratic nomination for governor in 2004 in the deeply red state of Montana. He ran on a ticket with Republican Lieutenant Governor candidate John Bollinger. He chose Bollinger. Now that's bipartisanship. That's a way to end the polarization in America. Although George Bush carried Montana with 60% of the vote or better, Governor Schweitzer's bipartisan ticket was elected easily over the Republican candidate. How did he do it? Well, you're about to find out. As governor, Schweitzer has continued to stir the pot, including suggesting last summer that Montana's National Guard troops be recalled from Iraq to help fight forest fires in the state, which may well be a more important purpose. He's getting a great deal of attention for his efforts to convert Montana's huge coal reserves into fuel, and he's going to talk about that. I was fascinated to hear this in the 101 classroom. He's been in Washington this week, wowing elected officials and journalists alike at the National Governors Association, and he just finished that presentation to students on a wide range of subjects in my American politics class. Please join me in giving a warm Virginia welcome to Montana's great governor, Brian Schweitzer.
Thank you.
Even more bullshit than the left.
No, we're all right. Give him the $10 for that pack of lies. Well, it's great to be here. It's great to be in Virginia. And we share a lot of values with you folks from Virginia. As you know, your native son, Thomas Jefferson, is very important to us in Montana as well. Because had it not been for Thomas Jefferson and his foresight in the Louisiana Purchase, the governor of Montana would be speaking to you today in French. It was a couple hundred years ago that TJ, we call him back in Montana, had the foresight of making that purchase. And at the time, it was an outrage. It was an outrage. Why would we give the French all of this money for a complete unknown area? And then to send this crazy trip of lost souls, a couple of military people and a slave and a bunch of other folks who had almost no experience in the West to chronicle what we had purchased. And we sent them to a place with an uncertain destiny, and they were on an uncertain path. They didn't know the people that they met, and they didn't know that they had arrived when they got there, and yet we called it a success. And I guess that's more or less the way we've developed the West since then. It's been stop and start. But a place like Montana, where the Lewis and Clark expedition spent more time than any of the rest of the trip, because Montana is a very large state, as you probably know. If you were to place the state of Montana, the map, on the northeast, it would run from New York all the way to Indianapolis. It's a big state. We've got 96 million acres, 30 million acres of public land. Over half of that are wildlands, places without roads, places where the only way you can get in is to walk in or ride a horse, wilderness. We still have the most remarkable wildlands left on the planet, places where you can hike. And for those of you who have been to Montana, you know this is true. There are places you can hike, and after just a half a day of hiking, you can look around and you can't hear any evidence of human beings. You can't see any evidence of human beings. And in these places like Glacier National Park and the Bob Marshall Wilderness and more, you will begin to have a spiritual experience. You will feel closer to your Maker. And for those of you who are not religious, you will get religion, because only with the hand of God could these kinds of places have been formed. They're spectacular. And I would advise each and every one of you, if you get a chance, come to Montana. Enjoy some of the greatest artwork that God has been involved in. Montana only has 920,000 people. Montana is a diverse state. Eastern Montana looks a lot like North or South Dakota. It's the prairie area. Western Montana is mountains more spectacular and rivers larger and cleaner than any place on the planet. Maybe Patagonia of Argentina and Chile would be the closest place I've been. And we have quite a tradition in Montana. It was people from the South after the war. You know what war I'm talking about, the only one that really matters around here. After the war, when those folks up north were down here making trouble, it was folks in the South, people from Virginia, people from Georgia, came to Montana. They were the first people to make it out there because we had gold. And they made it out to our gold fields. Some of them made it rich, some of them didn't. But the bottom line is they were able to make it out. They came to Montana because it was a virgin place. It was a new experience. Those were the first people to come to Montana. Later, the cattle came up from Texas. And then there was a new wave. Right at the turn of the century, the homesteaders came. So my grandparents came, my parents are children on one side of German-Russians. Some of you know about this German-Russian immigration. These were, for the most part, Catholic people who had immigrated from Germany up to the Ukraine. And the Tsar had given them an opportunity to homestead there. They gave them the land if they would farm the land. And they told them, and this was the promise, you can continue to practice your religion. You can continue to speak German in home, schools. And we will not call you or your children into the Tsar's army, and you will have the right to possess your own firearms. And one by one, the Tsar started taking those rights away. And so by the turn of the century, many of these German Russians left. And they settled the area of Kansas, Nebraska, North and South Dakota, and Montana. They brought the hard red winter wheat. These were the homesteaders that turned the prairie over, planted the crops, and settled this land. So I'm half German-Russian. On the other half, also came about 1909, I'm Irish. McKernan is my grandfather's name and my mother's name. So I am torn. My personality is torn. I have a split personality. On one side, I have this German engineering, methodic, logical, sequential side. And on the other side, I'd just like to have a drink and do a little fooling around. So it makes a pretty good politician. I was sworn in just a little over a year ago. I'm only first year in to the first office I've ever been elected to. I haven't been elected to county commission, or legislature, or anything else. This is the first job that I've been elected to, and you heard my resume. I've worked around the world. I've been in 27 countries around the world, and a great part of it was in the Middle East, but also in Asia, South America, developing irrigation projects, exporting American agricultural products all over the world, and having a relationship with people from all over the world. And I traveled to a lot of high schools, and I actually just told this to the class that I was speaking to. Some of you will hear it a second time. But when I'm speaking to high school seniors, I'll ask them, how many of you plan to go to college next year? About half will raise their hands. I say, well, that's great. And then we talk about whether they're going to a community college or college of technology or to a university. We talk about that a little bit. And we talk about to the maybe 20% that plan to go to the military, and then there's another 20 or 30% that say, I don't know what I'm going to do. But then I say something to them that catches their attention. I say this to them. I say, you know, I don't think you ought to go to college next year. And I know your parents aren't going to like to hear this. And I know your school counselor really doesn't want to hear this, and your teacher probably doesn't want to hear this, but I don't think any of you ought to go to college next year. I think that as soon as you graduate, you ought to get a job, work for about 6 months, then get a backpack, a plane ticket, and go someplace in the world where they don't speak English, where they pray to a God that is much different than the God that we pray to, where they don't use silverware to eat, where they have a different kind of government than we do, and spend 3, 4, 5 months or more. And when you return, you will know more about your family, your community, your religion, your politics, than you would have ever known by going 5 years to college. And you'll save your parents a hell of a lot of money, because most of you were going to go off to college next year, and most of the courses that you took your first year weren't going to be worth a damn towards graduation because you were going to switch majors 3 more times. Go off. Learn something about yourself. Decide what you want to be, not what your parents want you to be, not what your community wants you to be. And we need better citizens in this country, and the best way of making great American citizens is to have American citizens who have seen the rest of the world. It is frustrating for me when I see the leadership in this country, people who are making decisions about international policy, trade policy, many of which their first trip overseas was on your dime after they were elected. And yet, as you travel the world, and I'll see many of you nod your heads, and you're in South America or Europe or Asia, and you tell people that you're from Virginia. Now, if you're in Argentina, they'll say, Virginia. Okay, there's a West Virginia, then there's a Virginia. Maryland is... They more or less know where you're from, and they'll probably even know that this is where many of the presidents have come from. They'll know something about where you stood in the Civil War. They'll know something about your ports. Meanwhile, you didn't know a damn thing about their country until you got there. You didn't even know they were a country. Because we don't train our young people about the rest of the world. We are so focused on ourselves, because we obviously know we are the greatest marketplace in the world. We are the most powerful, richest country in the history of the world. Why do we need to look at the rest of the world? Well, I think most of you who are here know that we need to look at the rest of the world. We need to understand the rest of the world, and they need to understand us. And today, more than ever, they need to understand us. If we could do one thing right now in this country, it would be send someone from each and every one of your families to each and every family in the world so that they could know and understand us. Because it has been a few generations since the rest of the world has held us in so low of esteem as they hold us today. Some of it's the fault of our leaders. Some of it is just serendipity, and some of it is our message. We look arrogant. Yes, we are the richest country in the history of the world. And yes, we do have the strongest military relative to the rest of the world in the history of the world. But we now have a very small planet, and we need to work together. And it's important for us to build close working relationships around the world. As I said to the students a little bit earlier, on the second day on the job, I was sworn in on one day. The next day, I went to my first military funeral. And this was one of the toughest funerals I've been to, but I'll just tell you a little bit about it. We got on a National Guard helicopter, and we flew all the way up to northwest Montana, up on the British Columbia border, to a little town of Troy. And when I got to Troy, and this is a town of some 500 people, I'd known something about the family, but not that much. Number one, the father arrived at the funeral in leg irons. He was in the state prison. The mother had been in and out of corrections for drug and alcohol abuse for most of her life. And this boy, who had been killed in Iraq, was 19 years old, and he'd been raised by this community. You know, there was some famous politician, and I won't even say her name here. She said it took a village to raise a child. Well, this town actually did raise this boy. It was his baseball coach from third grade who spoke. It was his fifth grade teacher. It was his chemistry teacher. It was his football coach. It was the county sheriff. These were the people that raised this boy. And the first challenge that I had as governor was to find the words for not just the family, but the community, to say the words that would soothe them, that would tell them that this sacrifice and this family and this community was worth the pain. And I've repeated that several times in several different ways, from different economic and social stratas, from families that were Catholic to Mormon and Baptist to no religion in between. And each and every time when I put my hand on a mother's shoulder, or when I speak to a youngster whose father has died, when I speak to a spouse, I try and find the words, and I'm not successful yet. I just say to them, look, if there's anything I can do to help you, if there's anything I can do to help you through this, call me. Call me at home. And many have. But I can tell you what I do at each and every one of those funerals. I recommit myself that there won't be another generation in another land fighting to protect an energy source for this country. We can produce our own energy. We just need to have the resolve. The other night, the governors have been meeting in Washington, D.C., and we had dinner at the White House. It's quite an honor. The second time I've been in, and it's quite a big deal. It's supposed to be black tie. I don't know what that means. That meant I didn't wear blue jeans. I wore these black jeans, and I wore a little blacker tie and a blacker jacket. Well, Nancy and I got there, and they hand you a card, and on that card is your credentials, and you go on in, you take a picture with the president and first lady, and by the way, we didn't give them a damn dime, so we took this picture for nothing. It's not like some of these fundraisers. So we got in there, and we looked at these cards, and Nancy was seated at that table over here, and I'm seated at this table over here. They split the spouses up. I sat down, and I had wonderful company at my table, Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas, and Bill Owen, the governor of Colorado, and I sat directly to my left was Jennifer Granholm's 16-year-old daughter, a wonderful young lady, and to my right was Patricia Kempthorne, the wife of the governor of Idaho. So we had a nice table, but I looked over at the table that Nancy was seated at, and this might be random, I don't know, Bush White House, some things are, and I noticed that she was seated between, this is a true story, by the way, none of the rest of this stuff was. On one side was old straight shooter Dick Cheney, and the other side was the brain Karl Rove. And I thought, boy, whew, Nancy's going to get it. And I was actually very envious. I was wishing I could have been seated there. It worked out, though, because Nancy's parents were both born in Wyoming. Her father is a Republican petroleum geologist. And for you Republicans here, you'll even know what I'm saying here. The Dick Cheney fan club has gotten really quite small. And so now her father is the last member of the Dick Cheney fan club, loves him. And so Nancy got a nice signature from him, and she'll be taking that back to him. The reason I would have liked to have been seated there is I would have liked to have had a conversation about hunting with Dick Cheney. And I know Texas is not Montana. We have completely different hunting laws in Montana, and I like to hunt. And I've been looking at new ways of raising revenue in Montana. We're always, you know, governors are always looking for new ways of raising revenue. And we have a lot of out-of-state hunters and fishermen who come to Montana, and they pay higher fees to hunt our elk than we do when we're hunting them from in-state, higher fees to hunt moose and higher for antelope and all the rest. And if I was sitting next to Dick, I would ask him how much he would pay for an out-of-state license to shoot his lawyer in Montana. That, you know, it'd be a little way to raise a little money. But then the serious conversation would have been the one I would have had with Carl Rove. I would have put my arm around Carl Rove and said, Carl, let me tell you how you could have your boss at 70% job approval. 70% job approval by next week. Think he'd be listening? He'd listen. I'd say, here's what you do. You announce that you're going to have a redo, a do-over, a second take on his State of the Union. And then you send him right back to that congressional chamber. And you walk him in there and have him kiss the ladies and shake hands with everybody and all the pomp and circumstance. Get the speaker and the vice president up behind him. Do it all over again. But this time, he stands at the podium. Look out across the members of Congress. Quit using the teleprompter. And look right at the American people and tell them this. Number one, turn and say, Dick, you're fired. And then say this, because he had some of the words right. He should have said, we are addicted to foreign oil. And I will be the last president in the history of America to send young people to some foreign land to protect our energy resources. That's why today I am announcing that we have a plan to wean ourselves from all foreign sources of energy in 10 years. I'm asking every teacher, I'm asking every family, I'm asking every youngster to join us in this endeavor. We need to rebuild that spirit of innovation in this country. We need people to be engineers and scientists. India and China will both graduate 10 times as many engineers this year as we do in this country. We don't honor engineers anymore. In families around kitchen tables in China and India, they look to their children as they're having their cornflakes in the morning, if that's what they're having. And parents dream about that child and their family who will be the engineer, the one who will have the innovations who change the world. There was a time that we were that way. In fact, I've thought a lot about this as I've traveled around the world. I've been in 27 countries around the world. And as a young man, after graduate school, I always ask this question. How come we're so rich? What is our advantage? And I thought, growing up on a farm, that it was that great abundance of agricultural production. Our wheat, our corn, our soybeans, our ability to raise livestock. But then I got to Brazil and Argentina and found that they're superior to us. And I thought maybe it was because of our transportation system, our rail system, our river system, our barge system, our deep ports. But then I got to Europe and found they had much better than we did. So then I thought, well, maybe it's energy. Well, no, it can't be energy. Metals, maybe it's gold. No, it's not gold, not silver, not uranium. It's none of that. The reason we've led the world for the last 100 years is because we've had the best technology. We have led the world because we've been the best innovators. We've had the people that have asked, how come, and then proved, how come. We've had people that ask the critical questions and then we're able to define it mathematically. That's why we have led, because we won the technologic battle around the world. But we aren't anymore. So, if the president would have challenged us, would have said, I need each and every one of you to sacrifice some so that we can lead the world in, number one, energy conservation, because I can't produce any new energy during the next 5 years. It's impossible with all the technologies that we're looking at right now to produce new energy projects in the next 5 years. So the first thing we will do is we will decrease our energy consumption by 20%. And we will do that without decreasing your quality of life. When Jimmy Carter asked us in the 70s to put on a sweater and turn down our thermostat and have one chicken in the pot instead of two, you know, that said to Americans, this will be the first time that we're asking the next generation to live on less than the last. I'm not suggesting that. We can get there through energy conservation. So during the first 5 years, we could decrease our consumption by 20%, and there's just little things that you can do. We're already doing some of those things in Montana. But the second thing is we have to look at our energy portfolio. What can we do in this country? Electricity isn't the problem. I'm submitting to you right now. You know, our base load of electricity in this country is both nukes and coal. We have coal. We have nukes. That's our base load. It's likely to continue. We can add to that portfolio with solar and, in particular, wind power. We're right now in Montana making wind electricity for less money than it costs to build a new coal-fired plant with old technology. Less money. $38 a megawatt for those of you in the utility business. We're generating firm electricity in Montana from wind and then peaking it with natural gas. Electricity isn't our problem. It's fuels. 60% of the fuel that we consume in this country is imported. Back in Jimmy Carter's days, it was 48%. Now we've grown to 60%. Here's some of the things we can do. And I've got to... Where? Huh. Here's some of the things we can do. Number one, we can grow biofuel and ethanol. Now, I brought some of them with me. Soybeans, you know that in this country. But here's another one, safflower. Canola is another one. Camelina, there's a beautiful crop. These biodiesels, in conjunction with ethanol, could produce up to 18% of our domestic needs. Here's some biodiesel. Now, I'll tell you a little story. About, three, 4 months ago, the Deputy Secretary of Agriculture came to Montana. Came from Washington, D.C. You know how it works in Washington, D.C. They like to go out and listen to the folks. So they get on a plane, they go out, and they listen, and they set up these big meetings, and they're writing a new farm bill right now. And so they wanted to hear from folks in farm country in Montana, North Dakota, and every place else, I'm sure have been all over Virginia, what you would like to see in a new farm bill. Now, since I'm an agricultural scientist, and I'm a farmer, and I'm the governor of Montana, I went first. So I went to the podium, and I said, Mr. Secretary, I'm Brian Schweitzer, I'm the governor of Montana. You know that 58% of the acres of wheat that we grow in this country are dedicated for export. 34% of the acres of soybeans are dedicated for export. 18% of the corn acres are dedicated for export. And those farmers that are producing those crops work 364 days to produce a crop, and on the 365th day, they give 35% of the value of that crop to the railroad to ship that crop to the port, and then it's put on a boat owned by a multinational grain company, and the grain is shipped to the third world where it's offloaded and delivered in local communities for less money than it costs them to grow that crop in the third world. So we put third world farmers out of business. And then, this is where it gets interesting. While I was in Saudi Arabia making them self-sufficient in food 25 years ago, our neighbors to the north was a little place called Iraq, and Iraq was the breadbasket of the Middle East. They've been producing wheat in Iraq for 4,000 years, but they now have some disruption in Iraq, and so they're our number one customer for wheat, American wheat going to Iraq. And so while we're sending that wheat on the train, putting it on a boat, and that boat going over to Iraq to deliver that wheat, they're over there loading a tanker full of oil. And that tanker comes all the way over here, and somewhere on the high sea, you got a tanker full of oil, tanker full of wheat, cross each other. And when that tanker of oil gets to the coast, we refine it. Then we either put it on the rail or we put it in the pipeline and we ship it back out to the Midwest so the farmer can have diesel to run his tractor to produce the wheat and start the whole thing over again. And the farmer just paid the freight both ways. Why wouldn't we convert those acres of wheat for export and those soybean and corn acres to biodiesel? Why wouldn't that farmer produce diesel for his own community? It would produce tens of thousands of jobs in each community, and the farmer would put less money in the pocket of the railroad to ship these crops all around the world. Well, I thought that made sense. I'd done my research, I'd done my homework, and explained to them that this would displace 18% of the oil that we're importing for the farms that we need to run, factories we need to run, and trucks can move this stuff around. So, I'm standing here at the podium, I finish, he's listening, and without taking a note, he said, "Next." That's the level of listening that we've got going on. So, now you're saying, all right, fine. So you're going to get 18%. You're going to displace all these acres of grain, and you're going to get to maybe 15, 18%. What else? That takes us from 60% down to 42%. What else? How are we going to get there in 10 years? Well, there's a lot of ideas, and here's one of them. Now, this is some coal from Montana. Now, you know about coal. Dirty, right? Really dirty. We don't like coal. Anybody in the room? Show me your hands. We know all about coal. A lot of mercury, a lot of sulfur, and in particular, a lot of carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gases. You keep burning coal, you're going to destroy the planet. Right? Well, maybe. It was in 1923 that a couple of German scientists, one by the name of Fischer and the other by the name of Tropsch, they were fooling around, and they found a way of converting coal to liquid fuel. Well, at that time, the price of oil was about 50 cents a barrel, so this process actually cost a lot more than oil. No one was interested in it. But then by the late 30s, early 40s, you have the German war machine that was using a great deal of fuel, and they lost access to crude oil from Romania and the Middle East. So they were forced to go to the Fischer-Tropsch process, and it was the Germans in World War II that were converting coal directly to diesel and to some extent gasoline and a lot of aviation fuel. At the end of World War II, now you know about this, remember the Germans were ahead of us on rocket technology, and we recognized that we wanted to get in and get some of those scientists before the Russians did? Well, as it turned out, they got half and we got half. That was the deal. But at the same time, when we got those rocket scientists, we also got Fischer-Tropsch scientists. And we brought a bunch of these German scientists over here, and we started a Manhattan-style project. And in Missouri, by 1953, we were producing 1,000 barrels of gasoline a day using coal. But it was that same year, 1953, that the four major oil companies signed an exclusive agreement to extract the oil in Saudi Arabia, and they formed the Aramco Company. You know about this, the Arabian American Oil Company. So why would you mess around with coal when we now have the opportunity to have generations of oil? We are no longer going to be in a situation where the American people would have to decide to conserve or to switch the way they run their businesses and their homes. So we forgot all about this technology, but not South Africans. They picked this up about 40 years ago. And Sasol, write that name down. There's a company you can Google. They've been doing this for 40 years. S-A-S-O-L, Sasol. They've been producing their fuels from coal. Now, you know about old coal technology, and we'll just do a little refresher course. By the way, I looked around this room, and I can see that you guys are a lot smarter than the average bears, so we're going to do a little chemistry and physics in this conversation so that you can go home and say, look, I heard how it's done, and here's where the carbon goes, here's where the hydrogen goes, and this is where the oxygen are, and that's how you make the diesel. We're going to get to that in a minute. But old coal technology is done like this. We've been doing it for 150 years. Here's how you do it. You dig the coal, crush the coal, then you ignite the coal, and you make a great big blue flame. And that big blue flame superheats water. And that water becomes a steam. And that steam runs out through a jet, and it runs a turbine, and the turbine generates the electricity. Right? That's old coal technology. And then since you're burning this coal, you got to have a smokestack. You got to have a smokestack to get the things, you know, away from right there at that plant. And so what we do is we build great big smokestacks. We make them high enough, well, really high, so that the mercury and sulfur and particulate matter that we put up through that smokestack in this community doesn't land in your own community. It goes to somebody else's backyard. So we've been doing that for the last 100 years. And now we have a situation where here in the east you have acid rain. As you know, we have a great deal of non-naturally occurring mercury, and we have the incidence of autism increasing at huge percentages, and there are families in this room right now who are nodding their heads. And Nancy and I know about this because 19 years ago we had a child who was born and his development was a little arrested, and of course we have an autistic person in our family. We know the results of mercury. We also know this, that during the next 30 years, China and India, who are rapidly increasing the percent of their population into the middle class, they are going to produce energy. And the only energy source they have is not oil, not gas. They have coal. They don't have as much coal as we do in the United States, but they have coal. During the next 30 years, they will generate more electricity and carbon dioxide and mercury and sulfur than the rest of the world has during the last 100 years. So if you don't like the carbon dioxide levels now, if you don't like the mercury and the sulfur right now, get used to it, because they're going to make smokestacks high enough that some of that mercury and sulfur are going to make it here, and all of that carbon dioxide is going to go into our atmosphere. So if we can develop this technology that removes 100% of the mercury, 100% of the sulfur, and even the carbon dioxide that you can pump right back into the earth and sequester, we might just save the planet. And what would be wrong with that? I'm going to show you how this works. Imagine if you had a thermos jug made of steel. And that thermos jug is 30 feet in diameter. It's like this. 30 feet in diameter and 130 feet high. And you have a removable lid just like this one. And that removable lid would allow you to, for example, put 30 ton of coal in the top. And then you screw the top back on. You introduce a flame at the bottom. And in this chamber, you superheat the coal to 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit and 1,800 pounds per square inch. And at those equations, you will start to get a methane gas to come off, CH3. So now you have a carbon and three hydrogens come off. That is natural gas. In that natural gas, there will be a little mercury and a little sulfur. You can peel those out. Easy chemistry. So you'll get to a pure CH3. Now, once you've got your natural gas, you can generate electricity with it, or you can send that gas to someone's home, or you can use it for some other industrial process. But again, I don't think we have a shortage of electricity. I don't think our problem is electricity. So what I would do with it is I would pump that gas into another chamber. And that chamber is a reactor chamber that's 130 feet high and 30 feet in diameter. But this time around, you're just pumping gas in there, carbon and hydrogen. You pump some more oxygen in there, and then you use cobalt as a catalyst. And it's 2 micron cobalt. You blast that in, and it will break the carbon from the hydrogen. Now you just have random carbons and hydrogens and oxygens all running around in that chamber. And then you get to put it back in the sequence that you choose. If you want to make diesel, gasoline, aviation fuel, fertilizer, plastics, you pick it. You build it. Because you now have the building blocks to do whatever you like. Now you think this is space age? It's not. They developed it in 1923. The Germans used it in the 40s. The South Africans have been doing it. And by the way, Shell Oil Company is building a dozen of these plants in China right now. General Electric has this gasification technology. The Southern Company, which is the utility a couple of states down from you, has this gasification technology. And you're saying, all right, because you are smarter than the average bear, if any of this is true, how come we haven't been doing it? Reasonable question, right? If we have this technology, why didn't we do it before? Here's why. This technology will cost $1 a gallon. That means the price of oil has got to be above $30 a barrel to make this competitive with oil. Now, who knows what the price of oil is right now? Really smarter than the average bear. In the 60s, And does anybody, can anybody tell me what was the average price, and you can be plus or minus $4 or $5, the average price of oil from, say, 1991 to 2001 before the World Trade Center? Or even lower. Maybe $18, $19, because it actually got down to like $12 and $13 for a little while. $18, $19, $20. So who in their right mind would use this technology when you could buy oil for $20 or $25? Break-evens at $30 a barrel. I think most of the people in America today believe the price of oil will come down from 62. Might get to 50, 40, 35, might even get to $30 a barrel again. We might get gasoline back down to $1.25, $1.30. But there are very few people in the energy business today that believe the price of oil is going to spend much time under $30 a barrel during the course of the next 20 years. All right, how much coal do we have? How much difference could we make? We consume 6 billion, a little more, 6.5 billion barrels of oil, but I'm thinking we're going to do better because the price is high and we're going to start conserving starting in this room. So let's just say 6 billion barrels per year. 6 billion barrels. Put that in the memory bank right over here. 6 billion, that's what we consume right now. That's how much oil we have to get domestically and import it. 6 billion. Well, let's talk about coal. USGS says Montana has 120 billion ton of this stuff. We have 35% of the coal in America, 11% of the coal on the planet, and we can produce 2 barrels of diesel or aviation fuel, refined fuels, 2 barrels with every ton. So there's 240 billion barrels just Montana coal. 240. 120 times 2, 240. Memory bank, how many barrels do we consume in a year? 6 times what gets to 240? There's 40 years supply Montana alone. Now, I'm not talking about digging up all of Montana, but you got coal in Virginia. You got coal in West Virginia. You got coal in Kentucky. You got a hell of a lot of coal in Wyoming, New Mexico, Colorado. And guess what? You can do this same process with oil shale in Colorado and Utah, and they have even more BTUs in the oil shale than we do with this coal. Break even there is $45 a barrel. So we are proposing planks on the bridge to the new energy economy. I don't know. There's some of you in this room, really smart people, say 20 years or 40 years or 50 years from now, we're going to be in the hydrogen economy. We're going to use electrolysis and we'll just split hydrogen from oxygen and we'll have pure hydrogen and we'll all drive around in hydrogen cars. I've driven one. Who's driven a hydrogen car? It's a great ride. $980,000 for this car. It's not quite as nice as the car that you're driving, but it's close. I don't know if hydrogen, I'm a real big hydrogen believer, but a lot of scientists say we're not 40 years out, we're 100 years from hydrogen. I don't know if it's going to be fusion or whatever that energy source is, but I know this. Right now our policymakers, if you want to call them that in Washington, D.C., their plan is that we will continue to use the planks on the bridge to the future from dictators, rats and crooks from all over the world. Let's go through this list of trading partners that we have. Let's talk about first my good friends, your good friends, and people you can count on, people that you'll never have to send young people to protect, and that's Alberta, our neighbors directly to the north. They have massive supplies of oil, natural gas, and then they have these oil sands where they have the kind of numbers that I just described from this coal. So we can count on them. They're our friends. Good hockey players, drink too much beer, but we won't hold that against them. So, but when you go beyond that, it goes to hell in a handbasket. You got Venezuela, and their new boss calls himself elected. I guess he sort of is. He's a dictator. His name is Hugo Chavez. He's partnered with Castro, and between the two of them, they're shifting Latin American politics far to the left. You've got country that I lived in, the royal family of Saudi Arabia. You know, 15 of the 19 hijackers came from where? Saudi Arabia. You've got Iraq, Iran, Libya, another country I lived in, Algeria, Nigeria, Angola, a bunch of countries that end with Stan. Those are not dependable trading partners. Many of them don't like us. They don't like our religion. They don't like our culture. They don't like our politics. And if they could destroy us, they would. And yet we're giving them money. In fact, most of you filled up your car during the last couple of days, and a portion of that money ends up in the pocket of a dictator. Well, that's no way to plan to the future. That is not the kind of planks that we ought to be putting on the bridge to the future. And I can guarantee you this, and don't just listen to the governor of Montana, because I have only been a governor for 1 year. When I tell you that we will fight another oil war, don't just listen to me. That's what our Department of Defense says. In fact, this technology that I'm talking to you about, I'm a scientist, and I lived around coal my whole life. I heard about this last year at the National Governors Association from Ted Barna, who works for the Department of Defense. And he started his presentation by saying, governors, you need to know, and you should be happy that somebody does this because it's not the job that you want, that there is somebody in our government, in our department, that is planning the war that we will have 30 years from now. We are planning what arms we need. We're planning how to train our people. And we're planning where those wars will be. And let me tell you where those wars will be. Those wars will be fighting our way in to get the oil that we need to run our economy. I can't tell you if it's Venezuela or Nigeria or Angola or whether it's one of the stands. I can't tell you that. But I can tell you that unless we're self-sufficient, we will fight our way in again. And it was the Department of Defense who said, we have a different way. We could do this with coal and oil shale. It was the Department of Defense that put me on this. And then I started doing the research. I started contacting the companies all over the world. The South Africans, Shell Oil Company, the Southern Company, General Electric, Rentec, Syntrolium, all of these companies that for the last 10, 20, and 40 years have been working on this technology in the event that the price of oil should get to a level that there is a different way. Well, we're at that way right now, folks. Here is an opportunity. And while I just said to you that we could rapidly increase our production of biodiesel and ethanol, get us to maybe 15 to 20%, this is going to take us a little more time. This is capital intensive. The price of coal is very cheap. This coal in Montana is $10 a ton, yet it'll produce 2 barrels of oil. And a barrel of oil is worth $60. That means we're getting $120 from a $10 lump of coal. That sounds like great economics, except that this is capital intensive. A plant that produces 50,000 barrels costs $2 billion. And you can do the long math, the short math, and all the rest of it. A lot of people have done that. Bottom line is you can end up producing this stuff for a dollar a gallon. We're working on partnerships right now in Montana with investment companies, with energy companies, with construction companies. And if we had the cooperation of the U.S. government, if we had a Congress that was not stuck in the mud, if we had a Congress that understood that our very way of life is challenged by our ability to produce energy into the next generation, we could get there in 10 years. But since we don't, there will be states like your neighbor in West Virginia and Joe Manchin, who's working with me on this same proposition, and Ed Rendell in Pennsylvania, and John Hoeven in North Dakota, and Dave Friedenthal, the governor of Wyoming, and yes, the governor of Montana. We'll do it anyway, because we're not counting on Congress doing a damn thing but talking about it. So you can be assured that if we do nothing more during the course of the next 5, 10, 20 years, you'll hear more and more about these synthetic fuels. And it is the way of the future, because I will not be part of a country that sends another generation to fight our way in to get the energy that we need for the future. We need to be self-sufficient. I'll take some questions. Thank you. In the back, we have a question. Sure, come up to the microphone. Oof, you got this written down. Have you practiced it?
Okay. I have, actually, but it's not going to work. How much will the Fischer-Tropsch process increase our coal consumption as far as mining? And do the pros really outweigh the cons with the environment in mind?
Yeah, I think so. First off, we can produce it for a dollar a gallon. We take all of the sulfur and mercury out. For example, if you produce this synthetic fuel using coal versus oil, the resulting fuel has zero sulfur in it and no aromatics. The diesel that we're burning in this country right now has 350 parts per million of sulfur in it and has aromatics. It's a cleaner burning fuel. Now, in this conversion process, some of you are following the chemistry because I know that they're smarter than the average bears in here. You know that there is a lot of carbon in this coal that didn't make it to the CH3. You know that in converting from coal to natural gas, there was a lot of extra carbon. And so if we just dump that carbon into the atmosphere, we would rapidly increase the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. And I think, or I don't know, 300, 50, 400, then 500. We'll get to 550 parts per million. And that means that the level of the oceans will be up about 5 feet. And there will be a lot of catastrophic events, I can tell you that. But what we can do, since we can separate the carbon dioxide, is we can pressurize it in pipelines and pump it back into the earth. That's already being done around the world. And in Beulah, North Dakota, where they've been doing coal gasification, this process since 1984, they are separating the carbon dioxide and selling it to oil companies, and the oil companies pump it back into the earth 5,000 feet deep where the oil-bearing rock is. And when you pump that carbon dioxide into the oil-bearing rock, it increases the pressure, which forces the oil towards the drill stem, and it also increases the viscosity, the slickness of the oil, so it moves through the rock much easier. And you get enhanced oil recovery, you increase your production, and they're buying this carbon dioxide from the coal gasification plant in Beulah, North Dakota, for $17 a ton. We're sequestering the carbon and making money at it. And that's what we're intending to do in Montana as well. So then the third part of it is mining the coal. You know, the coal that we mine in Montana is close to the surface, and we have these strip mines, which means out in these desert areas of eastern Montana where we have coal that's close to the surface, what you do, and I'm a soil scientist, is you remove the surface 8 or 12 inches of topsoil, and use that term loosely because this is sagebrush country. It doesn't look like these beautiful farmlands of Virginia where you can grow anything. That's why, you know, Thomas Jefferson picked it here. But we move that into a separate pile. We put it over here. We stockpile it. And then the next 30 feet of overburden, we put in a pile over here. And then we dig the coal out. And then the overburden goes back in. We sprinkle that topsoil back on. And 10 years after we finish mining, the surface where we've already mined looks exactly like the rest of the terrain around it. We're not disrupting water. We're not putting great amounts of dust or other toxins into the atmosphere. And so we can do it pretty environmentally sensitive. Well, I don't want you mad at me, but, you know, the largest coal mines in the country, the 15 largest coal mines in the country are all in the West. Wyoming alone is mining more coal than all the rest of the country combined. Sure, you've got coal here in Virginia and West Virginia and Kentucky and Illinois, but they're labor intensive, they're dangerous, and there are some more environmental concerns. You're closer to market, and it's a little higher BTU coal. I think you will continue to mine coal here, but it will continue to move west where we can mine the coal much cheaper. And especially if we're not mining the coal and putting it on trains and shipping it to you, if what we're doing is mining the coal, producing the oil, and sending it to you in a pipeline, it starts to make more sense. What else? Yes. Well, you know, I did. I think I mentioned ethanol, but that's part of the 18 or 20% of this biodiesel, this biofuels portfolio. We're producing ethanol, and we can make ethanol. It doesn't have to be E85. It can be 10% or 20% or 80% of what you're burning. We run out of acres is the problem with our biofuels. We run out of acres before we get to replacing the foreign oil. With these biodiesel crops and converting cellulose and crops like corn and barley and wheat and others to ethanol, with current technology, we can take up 20% of this slack, biodiesel and ethanol. But it's only 20%. There may be some new technologies, there may be some new crops, but to get there during the next 10 years, we're going to top out at 20%. We're not anywhere near that right now. But ethanol is part of the solution. We need a lot of legs under this energy portfolio table. What else?
Governor, question for you. I'd like to comment your main statement on energy independence. What,
Well, we could do that. You talk about Anwar? Well, probably more important than Anwar, a lot more important than Anwar, is the pipeline that's going to come down out of Alaska bringing us natural gas. And I'm supporting that. That's a contract that's just been signed. It'll string its way down across Alaska, come into Alberta, and down in across Montana, and make it out here to the Midwest. You can go up to Anwar and drill some more oil, and that's going to get you a few more months' worth of supply. But it doesn't finish the job. It would be a minimum of 10 years before you brought Anwar into production. It'd be 10 years before you could burn that gasoline. And I can do it cheaper. I can do this cheaper. And so do we need to go to an environmentally sensitive place like Anwar? I don't know. That's a decision that we can make. But I can tell you this. It has been politically polarizing. On one side, you have Republicans in Washington, D.C. that say, watch this. We're going to get our base worked up and collect a lot of money. So they say, let's have a bill that opens up Anwar. And but checkbooks are flying and people are writing checks to reelect Republican congressmen because, by God, Anwar. People understand Anwar. And on the other side, Democrats are saying, by God, you're not going to get into Anwar. And the checks are flying from the Sierra Club and all the environmental groups. And both sides know it's a red herring. Both sides know it's not going to move. They both want the issue. They use it for fundraising. And that's just one of the issues they use in Washington, D.C. for fundraising. Here's the big problem in Washington, D.C., and I think it's the biggest problem, why they are so polarizing and yet get nothing done. They have gerrymandered these congressional seats. Almost all of you live in a congressional seat, and almost everybody in America lives in a congressional seat, that a Republican with a heartbeat would be elected to that congressional seat, or a Democrat with a heartbeat would be elected to that congressional seat. And most of them have only one risk, and that is getting beat in a primary, because congressional seats have been built so they're safe Republican or safe Democrat, and there's about 20% of them that are swing districts. So those congressional members, now we're talking about Senate here, we're not talking about the Senate, those congressional members, they need to play to their base. Most important thing they can do is keep their base happy on the Republican side and the Democratic side. And I got to tell you, I don't believe either one of these parties have a monopoly on virtue or good ideas. And neither one of these parties are beyond playing this polarizing politics. And things like Anwar. Yeah?
Excuse me, one follow-up question. Earlier you talked about the old coal-burning technologies, the amount of what it's doing, how much it's doing, the changes it may happen down the road. In the last 35 years, we've burned twice as much coal to produce electricity. Our emissions from those coal-fired plants, newer or older, have gone in half.
Sure.
Due to technologies and changes. What we haven't touched, and I haven't heard one politician touch, the real root of our air pollution are the cars that we drive. That, to me, would be the first place to go, but it's the last place anybody wants to go. Again, your comment about, are we the generation that tells our children they can't have it as well as we do?
A couple of thoughts. The place to start in coal technology is on the input, not on the output side. To try and scrub those stacks is expensive, number one. And number two, you can get to 50%, maybe 80%. I think we're going to get to 90% on mercury, but we're going to continue to put mercury in the atmosphere. I'd rather get back to zero. Same goes for sulfur. When I talk about this biodiesel, and when I talk about the synthetic fuel, remember I said that the diesel the EPA allows in this country right now has 350 parts per million of sulfur in it. And this synthetic fuel that you make from coal is zero. So it's a cleaner burning fuel. If a diesel-operated bus started up right out in front here right now and we opened the door, we'd have that black smoke come in here with the particulate matter and sulfur and all the rest of it. If it was burning synthetic fuel, nothing. You don't get black smoke and you don't get sulfur. So it's a cleaner burning fuel. And I like a diesel engine better than a gasoline engine. It's a more efficient engine. I think that we need to get to diesel hybrids. How many of you drive a hybrid car right now? There you go. You're driving a Prius, for example. You know, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal, and you might not believe what they say, but I like the Wall Street Journal, everything but the editorial page. And And they had a reporter who went to Detroit, and he drove a Prius from Detroit to Washington, D.C., and then he got in a Volkswagen Jetta and drove that Volkswagen Jetta on diesel back to Detroit. And the Prius, I think, what do they claim the mileage would be?
I get about 52 miles a gallon, and I just drove here from St. Louis on 1.5 tanks a day.
And what this reporter found is that he actually got better gas mileage with the Jetta by 4 miles per gallon, even though they were advertising less, because he was driving at 70 miles per hour in the Prius. And they said, well, if you were driving a little slower, if you're braking more, you'd have gotten a little better. Versus the Jetta, got in, drove at the same speed, and he actually had better gas mileage. And if you're using synthetic fuels in a diesel engine, it's a very clean burning engine. And so I think on both ends, the technology, we need to clean up the stacks we've got right now. But I want to go back to what I said about China and India. They are going to bring more people into the middle class. You know that only 8/10 of the people in China have a car? And yet they're the second largest importer of oil in the world. And what happens when they get to 2%, then 4%, then 8%? And they continue to burn their fuels in the old way. And electricity. When they get to use as much electricity as all of us use in this room, can you imagine how many coal plants they're going to have spewing carbon dioxide and sulfur and mercury into the atmosphere? Now, in the western United States right now, more than 50% of the non-naturally occurring mercury in our atmosphere and in our soil and water came from China already. It's big. Mercury is a problem. Yes.
Governor, given today's oil prices and given the expectation that the oil prices will stay high, wouldn't you expect capital to go into this gasification and liquefaction of coal in a massive way through the market, or are you advocating public policy changes?
It would happen faster with a public-private partnership. It would happen faster if we had Washington, D.C. get off the dime. But I was last week in New York City on Wall Street talking to folks about financing this. 3 weeks ago, I was down in Atlanta with the Southern Company. I met with General Electric here in the last couple of days. So we're putting together the partnerships to do it anyway. So is Wyoming. So is West Virginia. They're building one of these plants in Pennsylvania right now. But that's with public money. They're building a 5,000-barrel plant that's converting their anthracite to diesel right now in Pennsylvania. It would happen faster if we had public-private partnerships. But given the price of oil, if the price of oil is going to stay up, it's going to get built. And like, I don't know, how many of you saw 60 Minutes? That segment. Okay. Like I said on 60 Minutes, all of these companies I meet with, whether it's the big railroads that are diesel burners or the technology companies, Bechtel or Fluor or Peter Kiewit, that will build these things, or whether it's the Southern Company or GE or Shell or Sasol, they all want to be the first one to build the second plant because they know there's going to be engineering challenges. The plants that they have in South Africa, they're not clean. The technology exists to be clean now, but when they built them, no one cared about mercury or sulfur, so they just dump it. Just like a refinery does. And carbon dioxide, who cared about that in South Africa? So there are some engineering challenges to bring these refineries on stream. They know they can do it. Bechtel knows they can build it. Chevron's technology that GE now owns, they know they can do it because they've built scale size. Southern Company's already built some gasifiers. The Shell's building them in China right now. But it's going to be some engineering challenges. So we need some of America's biggest corporations to come together and say, all right, look, we'll build the first few and then we'll go our separate ways and compete. That's what I've been challenging corporate America to do. We don't believe we have a problem with investment capital. I've been talking about this for the last couple of years, and we've had people from all over the world come land at my office and say, I want in. How do I invest? And I say to them, I haven't got a deal yet, but I'll take your card. And so we're going to have a deal soon. We'll start building them, and then this thing's going to get kicked off. But very good question. Capital's coming. Yes.
So how does the public participate in this? You alluded to earlier that 60% of our petroleum goes to transportation fuels, and that I can't remember your numbers. I wasn't listening properly. But how many barrels we can get out of syn fuels? But you also mentioned, you know, President Bush should have redone his speech, and one of the things he should have said was that, you know, we as the public, we need to conserve. Where does the conservation, or let me put it a different way, what about efficiency? Let's use it more efficiently rather than conserve it.
Right.
You have people driving Priuses, you drive a diesel, you are more efficient. How do we encourage that? Is it a tax on fuels? Is it a tax on carbon-based fuels?
Can be that, or it can be tax incentives like we do in Montana. We have tax incentives for you to weatherize your home, to make your home more efficient. And we could offer you tax incentives, even additional tax incentives, to drive hybrid cars. You know, the CAFE standards are a real problem right now in this country because the cars that we make, since we haven't had CAFE standards, we haven't implemented CAFE standards in the last 20 years, Detroit got caught with their pants down around their ankles. We were making V8s, the bigger the better, Expedition, then Excursion, and then beyond. And we like big cars, and we're getting 12 miles per gallon. And that was fine when gas was a buck a gallon, but when it gets to 2.25, and then people start getting sensitive, and what do they buy? They buy Toyota, buy Honda. We are caught, and we've got General Motors and Ford that are on the verge of being upside down because they have the wrong portfolio of cars. There's a California has a referendum that they're working on, and they're not they're going to mandate that your petroleum that you use will decrease by a percent by a certain time. What it's going to do is it's going to encourage the use of synthetic fuels, ethanol and biodiesel, because those aren't considered petroleum. And that's a different way of getting at Detroit. You are not going to get Congress to pass CAFE standards even right now because you've got Democrats like the auto workers and the sheet metal and others that make a living building these cars. And they are with big business and the oil companies who don't want CAFE standards. So it is a relationship that means you're not going to move CAFE standards. So the other way that you can get there is by passing regulations that say, all right, then you have to not reduce the, or CAFE standards would tell you your fleet has to get to a certain number of miles per gallon by a certain time. How about if we say you have to decrease the amount of petroleum that you burn in your fleet by a certain time? That will spur investment in hybrids, and it'll spur the fuel industry to have more E85 pumps out there, more biodiesel, because the only way you can get there is by changing your portfolio of fuels. I'd love to say that we can get to CAFE standards, but politically in Washington, D.C., where they respond not to what we need, but how many dollars they can put in their pocket for re-election, it's not going to happen. That's a political reality. I wish it would change tomorrow, and that's why if we had a president, an oil man like we have right now, who could say it straight to the American people right now, this is our greatest challenge, believe me and trust me, I'm an oil man, that would have been just like Nixon when he opened China. The reason Americans trusted Nixon to go to China was he was the greatest anti-communist politician in a generation. And so when Nixon, the anti-communist, said to the American people, let's go to China, he had credibility. So if in a Kennedy-esque fashion, this administration would say, we're going to get there in 10 years, and we're going to invest what it takes to get there through tax credits, through public-private partnerships, through encouraging engineering students by putting more money in research and development in efficiency, not conservation, new engines, new fuel portfolio, public-private partnerships in building biodiesel and coal to liquids and oil sands and oil shales and wind power and maybe hydrogen, who knows? We'd be there in 10 years. But that's the kind of leadership that we'd need in Washington, D.C., not one that's looking in the rearview mirror. And I am not being critical of this president because he's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. I am not convinced at all that if we had a Democrat in the White House that he would have the credibility to talk about energy right now. He is well positioned, and that's why if Karl Rove, if he led this effort, if he explained to this president, they'll trust you because you're an oil guy. And when an oil guy says more than just we are addicted to oil, if he would have said, therefore, bang, 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 this is how we'll get there. But you know, the week after that speech, he cut money for investment in clean coal technology and biofuels. Cut the research and development for it. So It's going to take more than just words. It's going to take a commitment. And it takes a bully pulpit. A president can reach the heart of every person in America. They can appeal to your senses and say, please, I need you to be part of this. Yes?
Quick question. Which Democrat do you think in 2008 has a better chance in Montana? Are we looking at Mark Warner or Hillary Clinton?
Did you say Montana? Well, let me tell you about Montana. Start with, we have three electoral votes, and if you're a Democrat, that's the good news. Because Bill Clinton got 41% in 1992. And when he ran against Bob Dole and crushed him all over the country, he got 38%, Clinton did, in Montana. Al Gore gave it a real college try, even ran some ads in Montana, 33%. And Kerry got 38%. So, if we ran, for example, not Hillary or Mark Warner, if we ran Jesus Christ's little brother, he might get to 45% as a Democrat in Montana. Democrats don't win. But I'll tell you what, if we did have a Democrat that got to 43, 44 in Montana, we would be the canary in the mine. That means they win Colorado. They win Nevada. They win Arizona. They probably win a place like Virginia and maybe even something like a Tennessee. Probably, except for Florida, the rest of the South is lost. The West is in play. You look at governors around this. You've got Democratic governors in places like, well, let's just, you know your map up there, Montana, Washington, Oregon, Wyoming, New Mexico, Kansas, Arizona, Democratic governors. You go to the Northeast, all those Yankees up there, all those blue states, all those people that are, you know, latte-loving, gun-hating, they elect Republicans as their governors. So Hillary Clinton doesn't win Montana, and my friend Mark Warner doesn't win Montana, but if you're asking me who our nominee is going to be, I'm not telling you who I'm supporting. I'm just going to tell it like this. I'm going to give you the odds. And if you're betting people, I'm a betting person, but I won't put any money on this one. I'll give 2-to-1 odds that Hillary Clinton is the nominee. I'll give 1-to-2 odds that Mark Warner is the nominee, and I'll give 1-to-5 odds that the rest of the field make it. And here's how you know whether Hillary's going to win or whether it's going to be Warner or one of the other guys. If you come out of Iowa and get to New Hampshire and South Carolina and there's no clear winner and it's still Hillary and a cast of six, Hillary's going to be the nominee. If you clean up the field and you get to South Carolina and it's down to two, maybe we're down to Mark and Edwards, or we're down to Mark and Richardson, or we're down to Mark and somebody, or then you got a horse race. Because right now, 35 or 40% of America says Democrats say they'll vote for Hillary in the primary. But 100% of Democrats know who Hillary is. And the rest of that 55 or 60% is split among 10 people. So they're making a decision right now, no to Hillary. But if it gets Hillary and 5 or 6 people all the way through Super Tuesday, Hillary wins. If the field is Hillary or Hillary not, and the Hillary not is one person, the not could win. Okay, on the Republican side, I think your guy is the nominee. I don't think it's Giuliani, because I think that dog don't hunt in the South and Midwest. How in the hell can you live in one house with your wife and your girlfriend? That doesn't work out. I don't work in Montana. I mean, Virginia. McCain. McCain, I like McCain. A lot of you like McCain. He'd be a pretty good guy. I don't think he wins a Republican primary. Allen? Folks that are leaders in the Christian community and folks who are leaders in the corporate community, they both kind of like him. So they could rally around him. And there's a lot of people rallying around Allen. So it could be Allen and Warner. You know what? A lot of presidents have come from Virginia. All right. Thank you.
That's great.
Governor, you ended on a great note, a very really high note, because believe me, I'm one person rooting for the Virginian versus Virginian presidential race for obvious reasons. Governor, you were wonderful and terrific and blunt and refreshing, and we enjoyed it, and you properly made the Jefferson connection, with Lewis and Clark, although you pointed out in my class that there were all, 10,000 years prior to Lewis and Clark, and there were Native Montanans, Native Americans, who came before Lewis and Clark. But properly, you mentioned the fellow you referred to as Tommy J. In my 101 class. And forgive us, Mr. Jefferson. We love you. We really do, in your dome room. But we thought the most appropriate gift we could give you and Mrs. Schweitzer going back to Montana is the terrific and best ever six-volume set by the great historian Dumas Malone on Thomas Jefferson, on his life from the beginning to the end. And, of course, virtually a whole volume is on the Lewis and Clark expedition and the effects of it. We hope you will read these volumes in Montana and think of us, because you have a lot of friends in Virginia. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Glenn.
It's heavy. Thank you, Mary.
A little different story.
You did terrific. That's right.